Chapter 12. The Magic Trick. In this, the last chapter, I want to explain the erotic magic trick our bodies are capable of that liberates us to explore the wildest, most joyful aspects of living. I call it a magic trick because that's what it felt like when I stumbled into it in my early 20s. In the decades since, I've learned about the physiological and neurobiological underpinnings of it. All that science means I could write about it like I'm writing about a biohack, a way of manipulating the mechanisms of your embodied mind to make it do something really cool. The science behind this, mostly grounded in interpersonal neuroscience, is amazing. But it is not what I'm going to talk about in this chapter, because thinking about it as a way to hack your body will not get you there. Instead, I'll suggest you think of it as a way of knowing through erotic wisdom. But let's start with a definition. What do I mean by erotic? It's been your aliveness all along. Audre Lorde wrote, "I speak of the erotic as the deepest life force, a force which moves us toward living in a fundamental way." Ask anyone who had to pee for hours before they finally got relief. Ask anyone who went days without food and then took their first bite. Ask any runner who gets home from a long, hot run and chugs water straight from the tap, then palms more water onto their face and throat and arms. The physical experience of meeting our body's needs is also an emotional experience and a sensuous experience. It is erotic. Throughout this book, I've been saying erotic energy and erotic connection for a reason. I don't just mean sexual connection. I mean life itself. Lorde wrote in her essay, Uses of the Erotic, quote, "The erotic is a measure between the beginnings of our sense of self and the chaos of our strongest feelings. It is an internal sense of satisfaction to which, once we have experienced it, we know we can aspire. For having experienced the fullness of this depth of feeling and recognizing its power, in honor and self-respect, we can require no less of ourselves. Once we know the extent to which we are capable of feeling that sense of satisfaction and completion, we can then observe which of our various life endeavors bring us closest to that fullness." End quote. You live in a body. That body needs things from the world in order for it to stay balanced enough to support life. It needs to take in air from the world. It needs to take in water. We need the microscopic organisms that call us home. They make it possible for us to digest the food that itself was once alive and dependent on the earth, just as we are. And human bodies of all ages and abilities need at least some tender connection. One of the ways we get that connection is through sex. And that's erotic. But we can also get that connection need met through hugs and massage, through eye contact and smiles, through playing together, working together, singing, laughing, praying, or dancing together. All of that is erotic too, if we allow ourselves to notice how our bodies resonate with life force when we accept from the world these resources we need in order to stay alive. Am I alive? I'm alive. This is what it feels like to be alive. That is the doorway to the erotic. It replaces all the imperatives that would have us look away from our own internal experience. It guides us back to who we truly are. A lot of people whose bodies and sexualities defy the handbooks they were given at birth already have practice at ignoring the rules and choosing for themselves. LGBTQIA2+ folks, BIPOC folks, lots of disabled or neurodivergent folks, fat folks, and aging folks may already know that you can choose what you like outside the limited offerings of the sex imperatives. In this book, I wanted to offer tools all of us can use to return to our erotic selves, no matter how the world has tried to control, erase, or diminish us, our aliveness. Not everything about being alive in a body feels magical or even pleasurable, but we can increase our brain's access to the pleasurable parts of being alive by practicing a skill called savoring. Start with savoring. A large and growing focus in positive psychology is on the phenomenon of savoring, which, in its technical sense, refers to people's capacity to attend to, appreciate, and enhance the positive feelings in their lives. As researchers measure it, we take mental snapshots of positive moments, using a particular set of strategies to enhance our awareness and memory of positive moments. The strategies delineated in the savoring checklist include 1. Sharing with others. In the moment, we talk to someone with whom we're sharing the experience or tell others how much we value the moment. This translates well to an erotic experience shared with a partner. Saying out loud how much we are enjoying an experience while we're having it, or how much we enjoyed it, or how meaningful it was right after, amplifies the pleasure and solidifies it in our memory. 2. Temporal awareness. Time is our most valuable resource because it is the only thing that we have that, once it's gone, we can never have again. Our body's energy can be renewed. Money comes and goes, but time is limited and fleeting. Temporal awareness is reminding ourselves how transient time is, and therefore noticing this moment, cherishing it before it passes. This is an easy savoring behavior to integrate into an erotic experience. Time is short, and I choose to do this with my time. 3. Behavioral expression. This refers to the way we enact our positive emotions. We laugh out loud, jump up and down, clap our hands, and whoop. We allow our bodies to be so full of the pleasure of the moment that we can't help flapping our hands in excitement. If we have pleasure shame, as so many of us do, this is a great strategy for cracking open the shell of shame and letting our pleasure fly free. Practicing behavioral expression of positive emotions outside of a sexual context will make it more natural within a sexual context. 4. Sensory perceptual sharpening. This might be the strategy people are most likely to think of when they think of mindfulness. We slow down and pay attention to a specific sensation or group of sensations to the exclusion of everything else. We allow our attention to focus on the sensations around our genitals. Or just notice the sensation of your partner's mouth on yours, shutting out the whole world. There's an anti-savoring skill, too, with which we are all too familiar: killjoy thinking. These are the thoughts we have in the midst of enjoyment to remind ourselves of all the other things we should be doing. Sure, we got ourselves into the bed and naked, but there's still a sink full of dishes. Or to critique the ways this positive event could or should have been better. The sex was enjoyable, but my partner didn't have an orgasm. They didn't want an orgasm, but still. Or to dwell on what a struggle it was to get to this positive moment. Finally, we're here, but oh, what a hassle it was. The negotiation and checking in and all those feelings. Some people consider savoring pleasure to be an indulgence. Rather than really enjoying the pleasure they experience, they furtively sneak the pleasure in, quick and stolen, rather than expansive and fully owned. Savoring versus sneaking is the experience between the leisurely, candlelit masturbation session where you touch every part of your body and allow pleasure to ebb and flow like an incoming tide, versus a two-minute wank in the shower before work. Neither is a bad way to experience pleasure, as long as you are free of guilt or shame. But savoring brings with it an extra set of benefits. First, the practice of attending to, appreciating, and enhancing positive feelings can increase the amount of pleasure that we remember. If pleasure is the shy animal I described back in Chapter 2, then savoring is a way of taking a mental snapshot or a tiny looping video of the inner animal of our pleasure rolling around in the grass. Locking pleasure into our memories through savoring is a skill worth learning, not least because we make our decisions today not so much based on rational pros and cons of a given choice, but based on our memories of the past. To help us choose pleasure in the future, it helps if we remember the pleasure of the past. When we habitually capture the pleasure of the present moment, then the next time we have an opportunity to choose between the easy but bland pleasure of a familiar TV show versus the more effortful but more delicious and potentially more meaningful pleasure of an erotic encounter with our partner, our brains remember how worth it the extra effort is. But wait, there's more. As time management expert Laura Vanderkam describes in Off the Clock, when we savor pleasure and thus highlight it in our memory, we can remember our lives as more worth living. We look back on our day, our year, even our entire lifetime, and we see less of the struggle and more of the countless moments of pleasure, from the tiny pleasures of the meal you savored last night or the shower you prolonged to enjoy the water on your skin, to the vast, overwhelming pleasures of meeting your child for the first time, falling in love, or, after you give a TED Talk, seeing 3,000 people rise to their feet, hearing the sound of their applause, feeling in your body that you did something right. All of these glitter across our memory, brighter and more numerous, when we take time to savor them. Start with savoring. It is a powerful antidote to pleasure shame, but even more, it leads to a life well lived. Erotic wisdom. In the previous chapter, I advised women in heterosexual type relationships to acknowledge the part of them that is wise, the part that does not either fall into the old well-worn habits of a giver or react with anger against a winner. Both the habits and the anger are real, and they are parts of all of us, and we will inevitably spend a lot of time with those parts as we gradually find our way out of scripted, instruction manual sex imperatives and gender stuff, and into a sexuality that is authentically our own, vulnerable, curious, autonomous, and welcome. We will bounce from noticing that we're following the handbook to reacting against the handbook to looking to ourselves and our partners for what's true. That third process, looking to ourselves and our partners for what's true, is erotic wisdom. So I want you to get to know this part of you that is wise. You meet this part not through any rational, scientific process, but by accessing your erotic way of knowing. That is, through your body and imagination. So as you're sitting comfortably with your hands relaxed, and if it feels right with your eyes closed, I'd like you to take a deep, slow breath in. And I'd like you to release that breath even more slowly. And again, take a deep, slow breath in and a slow, slow breath out. As you're breathing, you can be aware of any tension in your abdominal muscles and in your thoracic diaphragm right under your lungs. Just let that soften. Let your belly be spacious. Deep, deep, deep in your core, your pelvic diaphragm that runs from your tailbone down in a sling of muscle through your genitals to your pubic bone. Just let that sink right down. And any unnecessary tension you find in any of those muscles, you can just let go as you continue to breathe deeply and slowly. As you open up all this space inside you, you begin to notice a pleasant, quiet light glowing deep in your core. And that warm, quiet glow begins to grow in that peaceful space you've created inside yourself. The more the light spreads, the more you begin to feel your body resonating with an intense, quiet joy that expands inside you as you continue breathing deeply and slowly. And that joyful light spreads through your whole belly and all through your heart and fills up your whole torso and continues to grow as you breathe deeply and slowly. This quiet light filling your arms and legs, enveloping your spine all the way up to your skull, and filling your whole head with this blissful, peaceful, joyful light. Sitting here, still breathing deeply and slowly, feeling so filled with quiet and peace. You know that this is a feeling and a place inside yourself that you can return to anytime, a safe and tranquil place that you carry inside you always. And as you're continuing to breathe deeply and slowly, I'd like you to allow the inner screen of your mind that's usually so noisy and crowded to grow comparatively quiet and blank and calm. You'll notice thoughts that want to move onto your inner screen and get your attention. Just notice them. Know that you can return to that thought at another time and let them stroll on by. Let your inner screen grow a little quieter and a little calmer. If your mind is like mine, it may never be entirely silent or still, and that's okay too. We're just slowing things down some, turning down the volume to create some space, the way you created space in your belly. On this quiet, calm screen, as you're breathing deeply and slowly, I'd like you to allow to emerge your inner guide. It might show up as someone you know personally. It might be someone you don't know. It might be a fictional character or someone from history. Or it might be an animal. Whomever you most need to hear from is who will emerge. Right now, this guide is a part of your own mind, your own internal sage, an expert on you and your heart and your sexuality, who will answer any question you ask as long as you continue breathing slowly and deeply. While you're in this safe space with your guide, you can ask any question you like. You might ask, what do I need? Where am I going? Who am I really? When do I love myself most? When is it easiest for me to be compassionate? For the next few minutes, still breathing deeply and slowly, you can chat with your guide and find out what you need to know. You can pause the audiobook for as long as you like, and whenever you're ready, join me again. You're still sitting comfortably and breathing deeply and slowly, and you know that you can come back and talk with your guide whenever you want to, because you carry them inside you always in this safe, quiet place. I'd like you to allow yourself a gathering awareness of your body in the room and of your hands and your heart. Know that everything that happens from now until you go to bed tonight will be touched by the peace and joy you bring with you into the room as you allow yourself a gathering awareness of your shoulders and your head and face, and are aware now of your belly and still feeling that quiet, steady joy, aware of your legs and of your feet, and now of your eyelids, which, if they're closed, whenever you're ready, you can open. I've been leading an inner guide meditation like this for about 3 decades. Sometimes people just fall asleep, and that's fine too, because sleep is important. But if they stay awake, almost everyone finds themselves in conversation with someone who knows their strengths and their struggles and always keeps their best interests at heart. A kind and patient someone who somehow lives inside them and yet knows more than they themselves do. This inner wisdom isn't mind, and it isn't body. It is the erotic self. It is aliveness. The magic trick. What it is. So what is the magic trick? What does it feel like? And how does it work? The magic trick surfaces the erotic wisdom inside you and creates a context that allows your erotic wisdom to merge with others. Simple enough, right? In his book on internal family systems, No Bad Parts, Richard Schwartz writes about a field of, all caps, self, as a different way of experiencing self, our sense of individual existence, in connection with others. He writes, quote, "Quantum physics tells us that a photon is both a particle and a wave. I believe the same is true for the self. Most of the time, we experience self in its particle state. We feel some degree of connectedness to others and, all caps, self, while also sensing that we are separate entities with boundaries and individual agency. Through meditation or psychedelics, however, we can lose those boundaries and enter the wave state. We become part of a much larger field of self, all caps self, in a way that feels numinous. We already know about magnetic or gravitational fields, but as theoretical physicist Sean Carroll points out, the universe is full of fields, and what we think of as particles are just excitations of those fields, like waves in an ocean. I believe there is a field of self. We can enter that field through meditation, for example, and become part of that field and lose our particleness." End quote. I believe the magic trick, as I call it, is actually access to the field of all caps self. In fact, as I read about that field, a cross between physics and spirituality, I thought of the Rumi poem. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. What if we could find ourselves in an uncultivated, uncultivatable field where our sense of individual existence melts away and all the rules we have ever followed simply do not apply? There is no you separate from your beloved. There's only, all caps, you, together, playing in the field of us, all of us, the unity that is the human spirit. Do I think there's an actual literal field of self, like a magnetic field or a gravitational field? I don't know. But I know there's a place I can go where I experience exactly what Richard Schwartz describes as his own and his patients' experiences. You might be familiar with the quote, "Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic." What I'm describing is a technology of human aliveness itself. If you are alive in a body, no matter what else is true about that body, it's true that you have access to the magic. The magic is a field in every sense. What does it feel like? It feels like your individual self disappears or diminishes or dissolves or melts into the other people. It feels like your individual self expands to encompass the larger you. You feel bigger. You feel as if you, as you, barely exist. You feel still and at peace. You feel restless with ever-expanding energy. I've talked to several hundred people who've experienced it, and here are just a few of their descriptions. It feels like God or love takes me completely. It's like I am one of those multifaceted suncatcher crystals for a moment, and the light moves through me. I feel, for a moment, like I am connected to everything on earth, like the ocean and the leaves in the trees and the stretch and breath of animals and movement of wind and rain and microbes are all part of me. This is what I mean by I feel God. I feel that I am held by and in and with all life. It is both powerful and humbling, and often brings me tears of joy. It feels like I'm floating in the universe. I see stars. Sounds fade a bit. My skin is super sensitive in a good way, and I can't stop giggling. It feels like I am connected to some sacred energy source in the universe, and at the same time, I am deeply connected with and in harmony with my spouse. Sometimes you may have an orgasm too. The actual physiology of the orgasm may all but vanish in the midst of the hugeness of the magic trick. Seem like something you might want to try? Let's talk about how. The magic trick, how to. How do you do it? Here's my formula to achieve the magic trick. Move your body in time with others for a shared purpose by choice. 1. Move your body. As a technology of human aliveness, the magic trick is about embodiment, exploring your body as a location of erotic ecstasy. Moving it is a powerful way to facilitate and sustain contact with your erotic wisdom. 2. In time. Did you know that when toddlers bounce in rhythm with an adult, it increases their cooperative behavior with that adult? Our bodies automatically shift their biological rhythms to move in time with the bodies of the people around us. That scene in Dead Poets Society, where the boys shift from strolling around at their own pace to marching in step together, that's a real phenomenon called entrainment. You may have experienced it yourself in a dance class, a choir, or a community hike. Sure, it can be used as a weapon, but it can also be used as a bridge that leads to the field of self. 3. With others. Erotic connection in a long-term relationship is different from other erotic experiences because it is the co-creation of a shared space. You bring your bodies into a shared space that you cultivate together. 4. For a shared purpose. The very first question we asked at the start of this book was, is sex important? Each of us has to answer that question for ourselves, for any given relationship, and in any given season of our lives. The answer changes. And when sex is important, we can further ask, why this sex? What is it for? Where is it taking you? You alone, or you together with a partner? 5. By choice. The magic trick is always voluntary. The magic trick doesn't happen through force or a sense of obligation or entitlement. Of these 5 components, the only one that's absolutely mandatory is, did you guess? Yes, it's by choice. If you have that one, you can probably do the magic trick with any combination of 3 others. You don't have to move your body, necessarily. You don't have to have a shared purpose, necessarily. You don't have to be with others, necessarily. You don't have to create a rhythm intentionally. The magic trick happens in a context of expanding freedom. It is curious exploration. It is play. It is everything in all the chapters that led to this one. It is everything in all the moments of your life that led to this one. I hope you notice that the magic trick does not by any means have to be a sexual experience. My sister experiences it singing in a group. I've experienced it swing dancing with a partner. During one particularly excellent Lindy Hop, somebody walked by me and my partner and muttered, "Get a room." What he and I were doing was erotic, and this passerby misinterpreted it as sexual. I've also experienced it cycling along a rural hillside alone. I've experienced it masturbating alone, as well as during sex with a partner. I've gotten really close, too, in moments while sitting at my computer writing this book. You may experience it praying with others in a worship service, marching in a protest, laughing with friends, playing a team sport, or as you work on an art project. The magic trick accesses the erotic, your very aliveness, not merely your sexuality. Practicing it outside of sex might even make it more accessible during sex. Practice the magic solo. For some people, this is a spiritual practice. For some, it is a therapeutic practice. For some, it's literally an accident, something they stumble on without realizing what they found. That's what it was for me the first time. Now, it's a love practice, a ritual I can share with my long-term partner to lead us up a mountain to a place where we might find something unlike anything else on earth. Your task with this practice is to let your body and your awareness of your body take up space. In an erotic context, especially in a sexual context, taking up space asks you to do something that might feel counterintuitive. Soften. Be at ease in the midst of tension. The cycle of sexual arousal involves an increase in physical tension in your body, generated in response to sex-related stimulation. Orgasm itself is the spontaneous, involuntary release of that tension. So a lot of advice for having an orgasm or even creating intense sexual pleasure says you should increase tension. But the magic trick calls for ease. Allow yourself to be in your body, to notice where tension is accumulating, and then soften the edges of that tension so that it spreads out. The tension doesn't disappear, it's just the same amount of tension spread over a larger area of your body. And when you're with a partner, that tension expands not just within your body, but also into the space between you and your partner. So rather than letting the tension accumulate just in your genitals, you inhale with a soft belly. Notice the tension and exhale, allowing the tension to dissipate out from your genitals, across your whole pelvis. Then you accumulate more tension with more stimulation. And again, you inhale with the soft belly as you notice all that tension building up in your genitals and across your whole pelvis. And then exhale and allow that tension to dissipate across your thighs and belly. Again and again. You let the tension gently fill you up. It won't feel like the type of tension that precedes a typical orgasm, where your muscles may be locked up and rigid, your breath held tight in your lungs. Instead, it will feel more like waves that move through you with your breath. This is the natural rhythm of your body. If you want to dive deep into experiencing what it is to live in your body, you could start with Yvonne Whitney's beautiful book of guided journaling, Sensual Self, Prompts and Practices for Getting in Touch with Your Body. It offers dozens of embodiment practices and reflection. Nearly all of them will work for asexual folks because the focus is on sensuality, literally the sensations of the body, not on sexuality, which appears in moments and nudges, but is not a central theme. One of my favorite prompts begins with this guidance. Choose a part of your body, the top of your head, a pinky toe, your left elbow, the roof of your mouth, and bring conscious awareness to it. See if you can feel into that specific part of your body, isolating it from all the others. Bring focus and awareness to the aliveness of this part of your body. You can also start by focusing on the pleasure of one partner at a time. Caress and kiss and stimulate your partner. Allow pleasure to grow in their body. And then create space between you. Allow their pleasure to dissipate. If they're experiencing genital arousal, let that arousal ease. Let a penis lose its erection. Let a vulva diminish its swelling. Then touch your partner again. It can help to begin your touch at the periphery of their body, fingertips and toes and scalp, and gradually, in wave after wave of stimulation, shift your attention to body parts closer and closer to their core. I'm talking about extravagant amounts of time, allowing pleasure and arousal to grow and dissipate. Grow and dissipate. Half an hour, an hour, more. And then, next time you and your partner connect erotically, switch roles. Eventually, the person receiving stimulation may get to a place that feels close to orgasm or to the edge of something. It will become increasingly counterintuitive to stop stimulation, to allow tension to dissipate. Your body will want something to go somewhere. When you get to that feeling, slow down even more. You're nearing the peak. And if you can be still inside yourself, breathing and easeful in the midst of all the delicious chaos of intense, long-lasting arousal and pleasure, you might blip into the field. If you don't, well, the worst thing that could happen is you experience extended erotic pleasure. Oh no, too bad. Amma and Dai. I'd like to conclude our story of Amma and Dai with the time Dai used the magic trick. How about I go down on you for a while this afternoon? Dai asked over breakfast, the morning after their first night in a long time, when they got to be alone in the house together. The night had been sex-free. Amma too exhausted to focus on the delicious meal Dai had cooked, much less on erotic touch. They had made a lot of headway on a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle, though, and made up a lot of word games. At Dai's suggestion of oral sex, Amma smiled and shrugged. Sounds good, low pressure. What she didn't know was that Dai's "for a while" meant about an hour and a half. After a lazy shower together, they got into bed, and Dai began not with Amma's genitals, but with her periphery, her fingertips, and the palms of her hands, her toes and the soles of her feet, the insides of her elbows and the backs of her knees, her armpits, the curve where her ear meets her jaw, the undercurve of her breasts, the undercurve of her belly. Amma was humming and sighing with pleasure by the time Dai got anywhere near her clitoris. After a very short time of attending to Amma's clit, Dai paused and lay beside her, and they whispered to each other about what they liked most about each other and their relationship. Then Dai said, "Ready for a little more?" Amma nodded, and Dai began again, not quite at the beginning, but spending time with Amma's breasts, bum, and belly before she got back to the genitals. She stayed a while, and Amma, freed from any expectation or performance demand, allowed her arousal to grow slowly. Eventually, her abdominal muscles began to tremble with tension. And Dai paused again, lying beside her again and chatting with her about this and that, little things, pleasant things, what they might have for dinner, how well the parlor palm was growing in its new spot by the northeast-facing window. She touched Amma all the while, stroking her hand over Amma's torso and arms and thighs. Amma's arousal faded to a light warmth inside her. Then Dai began again, and Amma's arousal grew again, and Dai paused again. Once more, Amma's arousal faded as Dai kissed her neck and whispered the funny sweet nothings they had shared for so many years. Amma breathed a laugh and said, "I'm sorry, I feel like all my arousal is just draining away and you have to start over." "Well, yeah," Dai said matter-of-factly. "I'm doing that on purpose." "Oh," Amma said, and she put her hands over her face. "That's really hot." "I thought so," Dai answered with a laugh, and she returned her mouth to Amma's clitoris. The benefit of taking it slow is that arousal has time to grow in every part of your body, not just in the parts we usually associate with sexual arousal. Amma spends a lot of her life in care and fear, and she rarely has an opportunity to allow her whole brain to disengage from the concerns of her life and family and settle comfortably into lust. Each time Dai stopped, Amma's brain had the opportunity to slip out of lust and maybe into an adverse space, but Dai stayed close to her, close with her body, close with her voice, close with her affection. So Amma never drifted too far, always going no further than care and play. Dai's intention was to put no clock on it, to allow pleasure to grow as it wanted. Once Amma knew what Dai was doing and knew Dai was succeeding even more than she realized, Amma got a serious case of the giggles. She wanted to explain what made her laugh, but every time she tried to speak, she burst into another fit of mirth. The laughter grew along with her arousal, and Dai laughed too, even as she kept her mouth on her partner. And Dai's laughter touched Amma and made her laugh more and turned her on more, and her body rode the tide of pleasure and joy to the shores of something she had always suspected might exist but had never experienced, a kind of floating, shimmering bliss, quiet, like a breeze in trees, only it was her own breath and Dai's. It's the kind of thing they say in romance novels, right? Riding the tide of pleasure to the shores of blah, blah, blah. It's silly. I hear it too. But this is based on a true story. I'm telling you, friends, it exists. It might not be someplace you can go to in your current season of life. Maybe you might never have a chance to get there. But just knowing it's there, knowing you might, isn't that what hope feels like? And even if you and your partner spend the time you have together just daydreaming about it, that's all it takes to bring it a little closer. Take your time. Stay connected and present. And practice, practice, practice. Good things come. The magic trick. Why, though? If you're like me, maybe you skipped all the other chapters and went right to this one. Like, let's just get to the ecstasy part, right? Alas, alas, you have to climb Pleasure Mountain. Sex researcher Shamika Thorpe, in her research on Black women's pleasure, used the metaphor of Pleasure Mountain with a collection of tools and landmarks that her research participants used to climb it. Similarly, the cover of Peggy Kleinplatz and Dana Maynard's book Magnificent Sex features a big mountain with the sun behind it because the metaphor they found themselves working with was a mountain. In their research on optimal sexual experiences, OSEs, and the magnificent lovers who experience them, the team found that the magnificent lovers climbed many different paths to reach the top of that mountain. From the peak of the mountain, they write, the view is always superb. However, the pathways to the mountaintop are hardly uniform. They are unique. It's probably not a coincidence that the two most compelling recent research projects on sexual pleasure both center the experiences of people whose sexuality is often marginalized, older people, kinky people, and non-monogamous people in the case of the OSE research, and Black women in the South in the case of Shamika Thorpe and her team. And in both the OSE research and the Black women's sexuality research, the metaphor of the mountain is prominent. The trick of the magic trick isn't that you can magically transport yourself or your partner to a peak of ecstasy, nor can your partner magically transport you. You have to climb. You probably have to climb the mountain over and over again, exploring different paths, attempting different climbing styles. Maybe you're walking up a switchback trail. Maybe you're scrambling with your hands and feet. Maybe you're tied in on a rope, looped through an anchor in the rock, left behind for you by some previous climber, and your partner is belaying you. Sound like a lot of effort? You're not wrong. Let me repeat, you never have to. This is a bonus extra for people interested in experiencing a shared erotic wisdom, a sense of aliveness that transports them out of their individual existence into a space of, well, magic. So why climb the mountain? What exactly do people find up there? Just as I've asked hundreds of people to tell me what it is they want when they want sex, I've asked hundreds more to tell me what benefits ecstasy has in their lives. And just as people overwhelmingly say they want connection, people overwhelmingly say that the magic trick brings them connection. Connection with a partner, connection with their own bodies, and connection to something larger than themselves, the thing I called the field, and they called the universe, the ultimate source, the answer, creation, and, well, magic. Connection with a partner. Feeling 100% connected to and loved by my partner, which enables me to feel more loving and compassionate in my everyday life. It improved our already really intense connection. It brought in the ability to have discussions about that and a lot of other things in a new, extra vulnerable way. Everything feels fully surrendered, and the trust is unlike anything ever experienced or seen elsewhere before. Connection with my body. It releases me from the near constant experience of fear I have in my body, if only for a little bit. It lets me glimpse what physical relaxation really is. It also gives me experiences of sexuality and my own body that feel really safe. After sexual trauma and a long period totally disconnected from my body, these heightened sexual experiences have helped me start to reconnect with sexuality as both a thing that is safe and a thing that is part of me. It has a specific medicinal quality for me. I live with daily pain from a spine injury / rebuild and an immune disease that requires painful weekly treatment, so my baseline experience in my own flesh can be a bit beleaguered in the day-to-day. I actually really need a thriving athletic life and a thriving sexual life to balance the experiences of pain and difficulty in my body with experience of endorphins, oxytocin, etc., but also experiences of success, joy, and congruence between who I am and how my body will express that. So sexual ecstasy is something I prioritize, prize, nurture. This idea of pain management and physical healing is a common narrative of disabled people in the bumpin' book of love, lust, and disability. Connection with the field. People say, I feel like I have a superpower. On really bad days, knowing that I have this ability to feel really good can get me through hard things, like knowing you have a hefty savings account or a secret stash of amazing chocolate cake that no one else knows about that you can tap into when you want it. It makes life sweeter and connects me to hope in the face of fatigue and all the suffering in the world. It brings me gratitude and joy and amazement that my body and being can do this after all the trauma I have experienced. My spiritual awakening was closely tied to sexual ecstasy. It makes me feel more deeply connected, not just to my partner, but to all of creation. I consider sexual ecstasy to be divine, and it is an important, though rare, spiritual practice in my life. This is something much bigger than sex, bigger even than pleasure. I think finding your way to the magic field changes people, enhances their connection to their own inner wisdom, grants them more consistent access to kindness and compassion. If you have the time, energy, and emotional wherewithal to try it, I believe you will find that it makes you a better person and makes your relationship a force for good in the world. It will look unique on your body and on your partner's body and on everyone's bodies, the way yoga looks different on everyone's bodies. Not everyone can put their legs behind their heads to practice advanced yoga postures. Some people's anatomy just isn't built for it. But putting your legs behind your head is not the yoga. Stretching your body in the direction of the posture, that's the yoga. Stretch your sexuality in the direction of the magic. If you make your way all the way to the magical field, super, neat. But even if you only move ever closer to it, I mean, wow. Wow. Astonishing changes can happen in your life just because you reached for the magic. But again, bonus extra, never mandatory. There are no imperatives in this book apart from consent. There are only tools and maps and seeds to plant. Chapter 12, TLDR. 1. Practice savoring pleasure in all domains of life by sharing it with others, focusing your sensory awareness on it, expressing it with your body, and other strategies. 2. Through something similar to guided meditation, connect with the part of yourself that is wise, the part that knows the answers to any questions you have. This is a way of knowing the world that allows you to feel most alive. 3. The magic trick for accessing ecstasy involves moving your body in time with other people for a shared purpose with mutual consent. You can practice it with a partner or solo. You might find it easier solo at first. 4. Why practice ecstasy? Because it's not just about sex. It's about your aliveness. It can deepen your connection with a partner, but it can also lead you to something larger, a sense of connection with what it means to be alive in a human body. Some good questions. What's it like to connect with my erotic wisdom? What time, attention, or energy might be worth investing in the magic trick? What might change in my life that could change the time, attention, or energy I can invest? What obstacles stand between me and reaching for the magic? What happens in my body when I'm exploring the erotic unknown?